Lawrence, anywhere within 300 miles of Medina, there are Hashemite Bedouins that can cross 60 miles of desert in a day.
Oh, thanks, Dryden. This is going to be fun.
Lawrence, only two kinds of creature get fun in the desert. Bedouins and gods, and you're neither. Take it from me. For ordinary men, it's a burning, fiery furnace.
Hey, how about rats? Desert rats.
Very well. Three kinds of creature.
I believe there's also quite a large variety of gecko.
Four, then. You're missing my point.
Do you not count the Arabian oryx? It's an antelope species.
They don't have fun. They're hungry and thirsty day and night. I'm trying to tell you the Arabian desert is not fun. And you're going on with a lot of nonsense.
No, Dryden, it's gonna be fun.
It is recognized that you have a funny sense of fun.
Yeah, it's fun having a funny sense of fun. Indeed, my funny sense of fun is so much fun that I have fun before I'm even actually having fun, because, don't you know, I've sized up the fun waiting out there and added it to the fun I eventually do have, compounded with the fun of having a funny sense of fun.
Get out. Leave now.
It would be fun to leave immediately. Today on our show, we celebrate the life and work of Peter O'Toole, update you on Harvard's evacuations, and discuss the controversial choice for this year's Heisman Trophy. And now, the star of A Pussycat in Winter, Colin McEnroe.
I attempted to merge two Peter O'Toole films to create A Pussycat in Winter. It was not successful. It did not go well. So one of our goals with the Monday Scramble, as opposed to many other shows that we do during the week, was to create a sense of not being quite so sure of what we were doing at certain times. And I think we have achieved that today, perhaps more than ever before. But I think it's still a good thing. As we go along today, we will be telling you about the deaths of two film titans, one of them Peter O'Toole. I guess you probably got that from this. Obviously, Joan Fontaine also died over the weekend. We are not going to overlook her towards the end of the show. Carrie Rickey, one of America's foremost film critics, will be on to talk about Joan Fontaine, whom she interviewed. She also interviewed Olivia de Havilland, Joan Fontaine's sister. As most of you probably know, the two of them did not speak to one another for about 40 years. One of the most everlasting feuds, not only in cinema, but anywhere else. We'll also be talking about some of the controversy around the awarding of the Heisman Trophy to an athlete who faced accusations of rape. These accusations of rape were never brought all the way into charges, but it has sort of tinctured that whole question. Jeff Jacobs will talk to us about that. He may also talk to us about his column today about the whole notion of bringing some form of NHL hockey back to these parts. Before we go to any of that, a story that was alarming this morning, and I'm hoping it's a little bit less alarming by now. Bobby Samuels is joining us. He's the president of the Harvard Crimson, and earlier today, Harvard had four buildings evacuated because of unconfirmed reports of explosives. So, Bobby Samuels, bring us up to date on this now.
The latest news is that of the four buildings, two of them have been cleared, Emerson and Thayer Halls, while two of them are still evacuated because of these threats. So four initially evacuated, two have been cleared, two remain uncleared.
These buildings are they're academic buildings where classes ordinarily take place?
Four of them are.
Yeah.
Or excuse me, of the four, Emerson is, Seaver is, and the Science Center is. Those are academic buildings, which traditionally have housed a number of classes and finals. And then the fourth, which is Thayer Hall, is a freshman dorm.
Now, the Harvard Crimson, I know, has been spending all day trying to piece all this together. In my sense, watching your Twitter feed and watching the site when I've had time, is that did this begin with some kind of anonymous tip to the Harvard University Police Department?
Our sense is that, based on what we've heard, that it was an emailed tip regarding the threat of explosives that signaled what has happened here today. And then the Harvard University Police Department alerted the Cambridge Police Department, and that has sort of signaled and allowed a lot of the different police forces and firefighters, et cetera, to come to the scene.
You know, it's always a vaguely irresponsible journalistic question to ask one person to sum up the mood of a large place and a large scene in a big institution and a lot of people, but I'm going to do that anyway. I mean, is this, as you're walking around talking to people, talking to other students, is it a fearful mood, or is there kind of a sense that whatever this is, it's under control?
You know, I think to a certain extent, it's too early to say. Just because, you know, I'll say from my experience, it's sort of unprecedented to have this sort of event occur where students are evacuated because of a bomb threat. Now, I've only been at school for 3.5 years, but I've never seen anything like this. That said, the school has been pretty proactive mm-hmm. in emailing both parents and current students about what's going on. So my sense is that students feel like things are under control, but as you said, I can't speak for the entire student body here.
One of the things that had to happen as a result of this, as I understand it, is that exams that were scheduled today had to be canceled or rescheduled, correct?
Some have been.
Yeah.
It's unclear the extent to which that happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's unclear the extent to which it will happen since others have yet to start.
Yeah.
But some were certainly canceled or at least postponed.
So right now you are in the middle of something as opposed to near the end of something, right? There's police tape up, I assume. There's a lot of emergency vehicles around, and there are two of the four buildings are cleared for use and two are not. So this is going to go on well into the afternoon before you know very much at all?
It very well could. We don't really have an indication either way in terms of how long this will last. There is some indication that things are loosening up a bit based on, as you said, that two of the four buildings have been evacuated, based on the fact that university affiliates are now being let into Harvard Yard again, which at one point had been closed off. So there are indications that things are loosening up, but in terms of how long it will take for this to reach a conclusion would just be speculation.
All right. Well, Bobby Samuels, president of the Harvard Crimson. I keep saying Hartford because it's on my brain. Harvard Crimson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to move along here. We'll tell you if anything else happens with that, but that's where that stands right now. We're going to move from there to Peter O'Toole. We have a couple of different interviews to share with you. One of them I had to tape about an hour ago because he wouldn't be available otherwise. That's Mark Lynn Baker. And after that, we'll talk to Mark Lemos, a director who, among other things, it is odd. I mean, it's odd how your mind works. When I woke up this morning and I was thinking about Peter O'Toole and I was trying to think about who we would interview, who could we interview, particularly whom I could get a hold of. And one of the things that popped into my brain was Mark Lynn Baker because the two of them starred together in a movie. And Mark Lynn Baker is from Hartford originally. And then for some reason or other, the director Mark Lemos popped into my head. And I was thinking, why do I think Mark Lemos would be the right person to talk to? I sort of racked my brain, and it sort of came to me later that Mark Lemos kind of looks like Peter O'Toole, and I think he's been told that a lot over his life. So you're going to hear him in just a second, but before that, let's play the interview that we taped earlier today. One of the people that we urgently wanted to talk to today is Mark Lynn Baker. Mark Lynn Baker from the Hartford area originally, parenthetically, attended Yale University exactly the same time that I did, and went on to fame and fortune. And one of his signature roles is 1982, I think it is, my favorite year. This amazing, funny, madcap comedy about a young man trying to squire a drunken Errol Flynn-like character through a set of comedy appearances on live television. That madcap, drunken Errol Flynn character being played by, of course, Peter O'Toole. Mark Lynn Baker played the how would we describe you in that? You were sort of a young man just trying to do his best with a really terrible situation.
Was the freshman writer on a live TV show in the 50s, like Sid Caesar's shows.
And, very much modeled on that. And so, Mark, going into this, how much of a Peter O'Toole freak were you? I mean,
I was starting out as a young actor. He was until very recently one of our greatest living actors. I knew his work from Lawrence of Arabia, from What's New Pussycat, and just from legend.
Yeah. And so
it was an amazing opportunity for me. At a very early time in my career.
Yeah, it was very, very early in your career. And so how was he? I mean, first of all, he had this reputation of kind of living the role of Peter O'Toole as vividly off screen and off stage as he did with any role that he played on stage or on screen. Did that sort of play out in your interactions with him?
He was always a consummate professional. He was a professional actor and a great actor. I learned more about film acting from that experience working with him than from anything else I've done. It was he was a pro.
Now, the role for O'Toole, and I believe the character was named Alan Swan, and it was pretty clearly based on Errol Flynn. But the whole notion of this guy was a wild man, and that it was going to be difficult for your character to get him to do all the things that he needed to do, or that you needed him to do, and that he was always going off on some rampage or other. So, I mean, obviously that was Errol Flynn, but it was also kind of O'Toole. Was he amused by the idea that he was maybe kind of playing a slightly younger and more chaotic version of himself?
As with any actor, you bring what you got, and he certainly had plenty to bring to that character. It certainly was informed by O'Toole's own life. You know, when we shot that, I believe I was in my 20s. O'Toole was 50, I think, when we shot that, You could see he'd been through a few wars.
Well, yeah, he's described. I saw a quote from him today that he missed the days. He had so enjoyed the days when one went to one's favorite bar in Paris for a beer and woke up in Corsica. But, you know, the movie's an interesting movie in a lot of different ways, in the ways that you suggest, because, first of all, it's about a clash of cultures. You know, it's about a man who's accustomed to having his image a little bit more managed so that he can be crazy, but a studio or somebody kind of takes care of all that. Mm. Nothing is ever done live. And suddenly he's thrust into a different culture, a 1950s live television culture, where, in fact, things have to be done live. Things have to work out okay. There are no retakes. And those two cultures, of course, are also kind of incorporated into a third worldview, the view of somebody making a movie in 1982. Did you get a sense? One of the things, senses that I get reading about O'Toole is that he did have a sense of what world and era he belonged to. He belonged to an era where actors learned a certain craft. And he wasn't really a method actor so much as a guy who really felt like he'd been to the right school and he'd really learned to do a certain kind of acting. And he didn't really care whether it was in or out of fashion.
I think the craft of acting is something that has not changed much over the years. What's accepted as reality is a question of style, and that changes, and we all adapt. But he was a great actor. His technique is not so far different from the craft that we learn today as actors. It's very much the same, and it goes back for hundreds on hundreds, if not thousands of years.
We're talking to Mark Lynn Baker right now, who co-starred with Peter O'Toole in My Favorite Year. So first, at the end of the film, first of all, did you ever see him again? Did you ever see him even?
We ran into each other over the years several times. He was, of course, did stage work. And when he came through New York, he came through. I visit him back, see the show, visit him backstage. There were a few times that we ran into each other.
And so you considered yourself a friend. I'm wondering, with somebody like O'Toole, who just seems to inhabit his own reality so much, whether it's possible for a young actor to kind of bond with him enough to stay friends. Did you feel like you had a friendship, a relationship?
The relationship that we had on screen is pretty much the relationship that we had. He really took me under his wing. He showed me the ropes. He gave me a lot of the film craft that he knew. He passed on. It's an old tradition in acting.
So how are you feeling today? I mean, you must be feeling a little sad. On the other hand, with the life that he led, it's a little bit amazing he made it all the way into his 80s.
It was a big life. It's a big loss for all of us. A great artist.
Mm. Do you have a favorite O'Toole role besides My Favorite Year?
You know what? Yes. I don't know if you remember it, but What's New, Pussycat?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do.
First script, film script that Woody Allen wrote. It's a fun film from the 60s.
He's also, one of the things about O'Toole that's, it's not completely unique, but, this is a guy who, first of all, at one point, you know, certainly after Lawrence, he becomes as established an actor as you possibly can be. I mean, he's Peter O'Toole. He's going to set the record for Oscar nominations. He's going to do all these things. But first of all, obviously that is a fabulously dramatic role. But he toggled very easily back and forth between drama and comedy. And he never seemed afraid to take on a kind of risky movie, a movie like The Ruling Class or maybe even What's New Pussycat. That wasn't necessarily a home run kind of movie. He seemed interested in what he was interested in and less willing to follow what studios wanted him to do.
I think he was his own person, his own man, and he lived that way.
Mark Lynn Baker, it's been so great to talk to you. I hope to have a longer conversation with you in the very near future.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for taking the time today.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Mark Lynn Baker. We're going to talk to Mark Lamos in just a second. I just have to sort of complete the circle of my favorite year and tell you my favorite scene from my favorite year. This may say a lot about me, I'm not sure, but there's a wonderful scene where where this kind of Errol Flynn-like character, Alan Swan, played by Peter O'Toole, is on one of his escapades, and he's loaded to the gills. And at one point, he has to go to the bathroom, and he simply barges into the ladies' room, and he's there urinating at a toilet. And a woman walks in, a very dignified woman walks in and says, looks at him, and she says, "This is for ladies." And O'Toole looks down at himself, and then he says, "So is this. But every once in a while, we have to run a little water through it." A line that Peter O'Toole could pull off very easily. So, as I said, the other person we wanted to talk to today was Mark Lamos. There are a lot of really good reasons to talk to Mark Lamos about Peter O'Toole, one of them being his not-so-faint resemblance, physical resemblance to Peter O'Toole, but many other reasons as well, including his own association, I think, with this group of British actors who came along, who were more working class, less Oxbridge-y, a generation of actors that he really, O'Toole, symbolized. We'll get to that in just a second, but Mark Lamos, who's the artistic director of the Westport Country Playhouse, joins us right now. And so, first of all, Mark, a second Mark in a row, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Colin. Thanks a lot.
Good to hear your voice again. And, well, tell us about being a boy and seeing Lawrence of Arabia. What did that mean to you? What did it do to you?
It meant a lot. It was a big experience for me. I remember loving the film. I mean, I think everybody who's ever seen it just has fallen in love with it. But I also thought at the time I had never, ever seen any man that beautiful in my life as Peter O'Toole was in that film. He was just ravishingly beautiful, masculine, and he gives this meticulous performance inside his charisma. So you don't just have a sort of beautiful man on the screen. You have a beautiful man who really knows what he's doing and was clearly directed by the great David Lean just impeccably. So that was a high point for me. And I saw it, I think, five or six times when I was a boy in high school. The most memorable time, I think, was actually on the night of Kennedy's funeral. You know, we were glued to our television sets for so many hours, and I just couldn't take it anymore. And I called up a buddy of mine who loved at school, who loved the movie as much as I did, and I said, "Listen, I just got to get out of the house. I need some escape." And he said, "Me too." And we met up at the theater, thinking we'd be the only people there on such a night, and feeling kind of guilty. And the theater was absolutely packed. And it was as if, you know, we could just sink into this movie again and watch a movie about a hero, a conflicted hero and a troubled man and, you know, all of that stuff. But it was an unforgettable night, and I've always since related my enjoyment of that film on so many levels to the pain I was feeling at the death of President Kennedy.
And I mean, one doesn't want to force a parallel where one doesn't exist, but those are two men who were known also for their physical magnetism, their attractiveness. As the word that you've used, that so many others have used today too, is beauty, which typically was not applied to men at that time. But you can sort of see why, at a time of grieving for Kennedy, you'd want to see once again that incredible sort of active, indomitable style of Lawrence. I think a little bit of a connection there.
Yeah, I see it from a distance, you know.
And the other thing about that is, you know, just when we use the word beauty, it's also Lawrence of Arabia kind of an early example of an actor exploring in a very, very subtle way questions of sexuality that questions of sexual orientation that really kind of weren't in vogue, particularly for an actor who's at a career building moment. But
yes.
But he does it in a very interesting way in Lawrence of Arabia, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, I think that was absolutely one of the things that drew me into the picture. I mean, I didn't realize at the time I was gay. I had those feelings, but I wasn't able to be out to myself. But I remember being so fascinated by that aspect of Lawrence. And of course, once I saw the film, I read everything I could about the guy. But it was very daring for its time to show that sort of sadistic scene with José Ferrer. And the naked guys, it was very, very unusual and strange and disturbing in the film. But the fact that, you know, O'Toole went there was, you know, also kind of heroic in a way.
Oh, I think absolutely. And by the way, you could have that reaction to Peter O'Toole and not be gay. I mean, anybody who saw Peter O'Toole and thought he wasn't very attractive was lying to himself. So we're talking to Mark Lamos from the Westport Country Playhouse. Obviously, it wasn't just one role. It was a fabulous career that spanned all kinds of movies, all kinds of roles, ended with an extraordinarily vulnerable performance in the movie Venus about an old man who has some desire for a much, much, much younger woman that he can't possibly attain. But did you have sort of favorite O'Toole roles or favorite kinds of O'Toole roles?
Well, for me, to be honest, and it's against the grain, I think, on a day like today, but to be brutally honest, I've never felt he achieved, again, the scope of what he achieved in Lawrence of Arabia, his first or second, really, time out of the gate in a film. I found a lot of his acting in films kind of arch and mannered, but I liked very much when he played vulnerable men. I was very moved by his performance in the musical version of Goodbye, Mr. Chips with Petula Clark, because he plays this terribly sensitive, uptight, button-down Terrence Rattigan character. It's just a beautiful performance in an otherwise kind of overblown film. And I think that's what was so... When O'Toole could go there and get away from the bombast and the size, which he loved, you know, of things like his performance in Beckett and Lion in Winter and that sort of stuff, which never appealed to me personally, when he played the weaker aspects of himself, the vulnerable aspects of himself, it was so brave, and I found those performances actually more affecting from my viewpoint.
You know, Mark, there was this generation of British actors, and I. Whenever I think about this day, about Peter O'Toole, as you know, you and I first met when I was working for Malcolm Johnson. The first assignment that Malcolm ever gave me was to go interview the British actor Kenneth Hay, who was appearing down at Stratford as, I think, Prospero, Brutus, and Malvolio in repertory. But he was sort of that generation, too, and I should say, in my favorite year style, Kenneth Hay took me out and got me fabulously drunk, so drunk that I couldn't take notes or read the notes that I had taken, and it was just, and that's kind of who these guys were. You had a long time artistic collaboration with Keith Baxter, another one of these kind of working class, maybe not to the manner born British actors. This was a generation of which probably Burton and O'Toole were the leaders. And what came with that too was this wildness and this almost epic and legendary and storied dissolution and this whole idea of starting your drink in one place and ending up in a completely different country. And it seems almost unsustainable today. I mean, these days, if somebody acted like that and did it so publicly and almost boastfully, there'd be talk of an intervention, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't work with an actor like that in this day and age. I mean, I have to say, about 10 years ago, I was offered a very high-profile production in New York, and I found out that the two leading men were into drink, and I pulled out of it. I said to the producers, you know what, life is too short. I can't put myself through that. And neither of them had the charisma that any of these guys we're talking about did. But you can't go there with yourself. It's a crazy enough business as it is. But, you know, yeah, with Keith Baxter, I had a long association, and he knew O'Toole. I also worked with Brian Bedford, who came from that same era. Mm-hmm. I think they were even roommates or something for a brief while. The costume designer Jane Greenwood was one of that group, all living in Bayswater together. And my 6 degrees of separation from Peter O'Toole actually occurred when I was a young actor at the Guthrie Theater in the 70s. Michael Langham, the artistic director there, who was a great British director, had just recently directed Peter O'Toole as Shylock in a blazing production of Merchant of Venice in London, just before he was cast in Lawrence of Arabia. And I remember Michael saying, without disparaging O'Toole at all, he said, I feel like one of the most gifted actors I've ever met in my life is now going to not realize his potential because he's been completely seduced by this world of fame and money and everything else. And he said, he's just a great, great actor, and you're not going to see that all the time. And I always felt that was the case in my estimation. But a lot of his films I didn't see. I never saw My Favorite Year. I feel like now that he's died, I should rent all of them and take a look at them again.
Yeah, and I just wonder if you could say a little bit more, too, about what that generation of actors meant. Most of them are gone now. A few still remain. But my sense is that it really kind of transformed acting. It injected acting, especially obviously British acting, with a different kind of vitality, that
yeah.
There was a different understanding even of what it meant to be an actor.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, up until then, you had a certain style that was vivid and very, very exciting, that was sort of embodied by the old Vic, by sort of very correct. There was a famous old actor named Donald Wolfert. All the actors of that period were really the ones who rose to fame. Did it by kind of overturning the rules. You know, Gielgud overturned the rules. He seems old-fashioned now, perhaps, but he overturned the rules when he hit the boards. And then Olivier came along really right almost at the same time and decided he didn't want to be the voice beautiful. He wanted to be much more naturalistic. We look at Olivier's performances on film, certainly today, and they seem very stiff in many cases. But I think this generation that you're talking about, Colin, they saw that, they built on it, and they never quite let go of their working class roots. You know, you read those Richard Burton diaries that were published a couple years ago, and I mean, he was always, no matter how wealthy he became, he always thought of himself as a coal miner's son. You know, and I think they all kept those roots in a way, no matter how rich they became. And that infused their acting with a certain kind of daring and a certain kind of, oh, I don't know, defiant quality, where they just said, if you don't like what I'm doing, the hell with you, you know. Which could be wonderful, or it could be kind of sloppy, frankly.
Last question.
They would throw out the technique sometimes, and they didn't have something else to sustain them.
Mm.
But, you know, how many actors go back to the stage as often as O'Toole did?
Right.
And go back, you know, in such a daring way to risk so much. He was booed off the stage a couple times long after he became a great film star. That takes guts, you know.
It does. Yeah, I read some of those stories today. Astonishing to think of him being booed off the stage. Last question for you, Mark. I haven't seen you for a while, but as a younger fellow, you did resemble Peter O'Toole. How much of that has come up in your life? How many people have stopped you anywhere and brought that up?
I never thought I did at all. I mean, it was flattering. Especially in Europe, when I'm working in Europe, people will say, oh, you look like Peter O'Toole. And actually, a very good friend of mine, she's always saying, I look like Peter O'Toole, more like Peter O'Toole today than I did yesterday or whatever. Mm. But I've never seen the resemblance. You know, he was very interesting. That I read an interview with him. It must be in one of his books, too, which I haven't read. But he worked very hard to look the way he looked. And as a boy, he wanted to have heavy lidded eyes. And so he would tug on his eyelids. I don't know if you ever heard this story.
No.
He'd tug on his eyelids to make them do that. And they did. By the time he got older, they sort of gave him this beautiful cat-like thing going. But I confess I never did that.
All right. Well, and if kids are listening, don't do that. All right. Don't do that. There's other ways to achieve that look. All right. Mark Limba, so great to hear your voice again.
It's great to hear yours, Colin. Thank you.
All right. Mark Lamos, Artistic Director of the Westport Country Playhouse. We have to take a break now. Oh, by the way, if you do nothing else today, pull up the clip, and you can find it on Gawker, as well as lots of other places, of Peter O'Toole arriving on the set of the David Letterman show for his interview with riding a camel, a much older man than he was in Lawrence of Arabia, but nonetheless smoking a cigarette in a cigarette holder and riding a camel.
Looking elegantly ruffled with a melancholy air, yeah. And all I wanna do is to be like Peter O'Toole. He can break every rule there is and do it looking cool. From Shakespeare on the Strand to the shifting desert sands, Albonian Lothario.
You know, there's only one college sports award that anybody ever knows the name of or the winner of, although there are lots of college sports awards. As Mike Pesco was pointing out over the weekend, it's like nobody really knows who's going to win or cares really who's going to win the Wooden Award, except for a fairly smaller group of people. Everybody knows about the Heisman Trophy. And probably everybody knows that it was won this weekend by Jameis Winston, a quarterback from Florida State University. This was kind of up in the air for a while because there had been an accusation of rape against Jameis Winston. It was never brought to trial. The state's attorney involved felt there wasn't enough substance to it or enough facts available, a good enough case to warrant bringing it to trial. So it's the kind of thing that hangs unresolved in the air. We're talking to Jeff Jacobs right now, columnist for the Hartford Courant. Jeff, tell us a little bit more about this and tell us how you feel, I guess, about the degree to which character and this kind of question should or shouldn't weigh in voting for the Heisman.
First of all, how you doing, Colin?
Good, Jeff.
well, it hangs heavy in both. I'm a voter for both the Baseball Hall of Fame and the Heisman ballot. And it's become, in a modern world with social media and all these facts being available and to be argued so quickly and so harshly, it hangs heavy now. It's given me pause, really, whether I want to continue to vote in either of them. And with this case, I gave it a lot of thought, and I came to the conclusion because for a long time, the state attorney down there, Willie Meggs, did not sound like he was going to issue a decision until after the votes, the deadline of the vote was going to take place. So I kind of came to the conclusion that without them going, whether to go for or not, I would vote for him. And then if they decided to prosecute, I would call on the Heisman Trust to have a revote if he was guilty. And if there was no revote, I was going to resign my ballot. I'm one of 900, so it's not like it's 50 people. It's not as exclusive a vote as it may seem as some other ones are. However, Meggs decided not to prosecute a few days before the vote was due. I voted for him. There's an integrity clause in there, and I know a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues, would like to see that better defined by the Heisman Trust, just as some of the things with performance-enhancing drugs should need to be better defined by the Baseball Hall of Fame as we move forward here. So, I mean, what are you supposed to do? I mean, I can't call the guy guilty of rape when American jurisprudence said there wasn't enough evidence to go forward and try and convict him of it.
Absolutely. On the other hand, we have the spectacle of the Patricia Carroll, who's the attorney for the complainant here, saying that she feels it was an unsatisfactory investigation and that she feels, and this will have a familiar ring to you and me, that her client, the complainant, was investigated more thoroughly than Jameis Winston was, that somehow or other her client wound up on the defensive after making this complaint. And I know this is something that you really care about. I think more than the average sports columnist, Jeff Jacobs, you've become very concerned with the climate at UConn, so
right.
and this kind of plays into it a little bit.
Yeah, that's what it really. I've given a lot of thought to this, Colin, and in this case here, the guy's name is Willie Meggs. Okay, he's from Florida. Let's be honest, up here in the Northeast, you hear anything like Willie Meggs. It sounds like sort of a stereotypical type of guy from down the South. He wouldn't convict some big-time football player in a million years and blah, blah, blah. And it's a really convenient sort of stereotype to label that guy with. The fact is that there was a teammate of Winston who he went after on a sexual assault and charged the next day this year. Peter Warwick, who was a big name down at Florida State, tried to change price tags. I forgot what it was, on clothes or something. It was like he's trying to make a $400 purchase turn into $25. And Megs went after him. And that cost Peter Warwick the Heisman that year, and I think it was 1999. So the guy is not some, you know, the way that maybe some people up here might want to portray him. On the other hand, you know, I poured through that 86-page release, and I've come to the conclusion the police were really slow to go after this and look into it. And now that's where I have less problem with the state attorney than I do sort of with the police investigation, which really seemed to drag their heels. And the whole thing with the athlete and alcohol and women on campus and violence of women on campus is just it's a very emotional subject, and the people I've heard it argued kind of in a lot of different ways. And, you know, women made it up. Sure, some have made it up. Women, they want to go after the famous athletes. Yes, they have. Famous athletes, they always want to take advantage of the women. Yes, there's many cases of that. So it's a really difficult situation, and I would say that a lot of athletes will get arrested. But the numbers do show, and there's some studies out there, that the conviction rate of those athletes is painfully low. So there's a lot of arguments that make Jameis Winston look bad. But I got to tell you, honest to God, if premarital sex is lacking integrity for the Heisman Trophy vote, then other than Roger Staubach and some guys from maybe some of your Yale guys from 1936, there would be no Heisman winners then.
True, true, true. Well, I don't know. So how uneasy lies the head of the Heisman voter in the form of Jeff Jacobs anyway? I mean, you feel pretty good, pretty solid about this vote, or is it going to nag at you?
Oh, it'll nag at me. Yeah. I voted. I'll tell you, I was looking back. There were 900 ballots cast this year, Todd. 115 left him off completely.
Mm-hmm.
So there, that's, you know, one-ninth of the constituency there didn't want to vote for him. So that's, what's that, 11%? So there's a not insignificant number. I did not vote for Cam Newton because his daddy tried to shake down Mississippi State for upward of $200,000 to play there, and that was not a court case. You know, crime case. And I felt that I wasn't going to vote for it. I thought it was a complete lack of integrity by the Newton family. And the NCAA ruled that, he didn't specifically break that rule because he was a family member, not an agent. Cam Newton won it. I was, again, like one of 105 that didn't vote for it, the same, you know, one-ninth of the voting. Did not vote for him. Feel good to this day that I did not vote for him. And then six months later, whatever it was, after the Heisman Trophy, the NCAA closed that ruling. So in the future, what the Newton family did would be against the NCAA rule. So, I mean, this is a moving target here. I'm going to feel horrible if somehow more evidence came up and they decided to try and convict Newton or something along that line. So I'm not convinced that he's totally innocent, not 100%, but, you know, I do know, I mean, I've got to at this point respect, you know, the process, and they didn't have enough to convict him on that. And, you know, so,
exactly.
Yeah, uneasy, yes, uneasy it does hang.
All right, your head rests uneasy. Jeff Jacobs, thanks so much for joining us today. We're really excited about the final segment here. We have Kerry Rickey, one of my favorite film critics of all time, will be joining us to talk about Joan Fontaine. Yes, we spent quite a bit of time on Peter O'Toole. Would be wrong to overlook Joan Fontaine, who also passed.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Greg Dyson and Jackie Lauper. The part of Bill Curry was played by Claude Rains. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and appeared in the intro. For links, stories, and photos of the Faith Middleton show staff grooming camels, visit WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, why does high-priced art have such a high price? And now, back to Colin.
Ooh, I'd like to see those pictures of them grooming camels. But right now, we have to sort of leave off our thoughts of Peter O'Toole a little bit. I mean, Peter O'Toole is Peter O'Toole, but you know, another fabulous sort of titan of the classic era of screen, Joan Fontaine, also died over the last few days. Joining us now, one of my favorite film critics, Kerry Rickey. Kerry Rickey, for 25 years, was a film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, where she reviewed everything from Room with a View to Shame and interviewed celebrities from Lillian Gish to Will Smith and both the Haviland sisters, as it would happen. Kerry Rickey joins us now. You know, one of the confusions here sometimes, I think, for people is that there's sort of a lot of actresses with kind of similar names and similar resumes, and people may even have a little trouble in their heads sorting out who Joan Fontaine was. So give people a sketch, Kerry. Give us remind them who Joan Fontaine was.
Well, I think many people have seen Rebecca, and she was the woman without a name, the second Mrs. De Winter in Rebecca, the great Hitchcock movie. And she had porcelain skin and doe eyes, and she was slim as a champagne flute. And she played vulnerable femininity and unrequited love better than probably anyone in movie history, with the possible exception of silent star Lillian Gish. She was... she kind of trembled. And she would grow up, or she would mature to be an actress who played brutal sophistication very well. But she was wide-eyed, deep of heart, and trembling, and kind of just the beautiful blonde with the big eyes.
And the two roles for which we remember her and for which she won Academy Awards.
She only won one Oscar.
That was for Suspicion, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's another role where, in fact, she is in something of a vulnerable position, right?
Exactly. She thinks her husband, she's an heiress who thinks her husband, Cary Grant, is trying to poison her for her money. And both were directed by Hitchcock, and she had the good fortune to learn from him and other directors that acting was thinking. You know, if you thought it, you felt it, and if you could feel it, you could project it. I have to say, Joan Fontaine and her sister Olivia de Havilland came from a kind of a wacky family. When their mother Lillian saw Joan and Rebecca, she said, "Joan seems so phony in real life, but she's really believable on screen." So I think the family had kind of a lot of difficulty praising each other.
Yeah, well, that's, of course, the crucible of greatness. I finally this weekend watched the documentary Six by Sondheim, and there's this little thing about his mother wrote a letter to him on her deathbed about her greatest regret was having him. So if you would make your child great, then torture your child, apparently.
Don't support them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, just quickly back to Hitchcock for a second, because she is fundamentally associated with Hitchcock because of those roles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been treated to, if not just not quite a deluge, a trickle of movies about what an odd person Hitchcock was, especially in relation to his beautiful leading ladies. When you talked to Joan Fontaine, did she betray any hint of that? I mean, was Hitchcock showing up and doing weird
stuff? Well, I met her at a formal event, and I wasn't interviewing her. So she was lovely, and she was very sleek and so streamlined. You could have put her on she could have been a hood ornament on a Rolls Royce or something, and blonde. And she was kind of both very sophisticated and very sporty. She played golf. She had a professional aviator's license. She and her sister were distant cousins of Geoffrey de Havilland, who was the founder of a great aviation company in Britain. And she was always in movement, but someone, she wasn't talking about Hitchcock there. Someone asked her how her sister was, and then she said some not very nice things about Olivia de Havilland, or not very sisterly things, shall we say.
Well, we have to pause and reflect on this for a second, because it really is maybe the most enduring, celebrated family feud in show business. I can't think of one that lasted longer.
They're the only two siblings to have ever won a Best Actress Award, so that's kind of interesting, too. But, I mean, I just think that, you know, Joan is the second child, and Joan said to a reporter in the late 70s, I married first, I won the Oscar before Olivia did, and if I should die first, undoubtedly she'll be livid because I beat her to it. And I think I think she always had something, Fontaine always had something to prove.
Yeah. And, I mean, it is also one of those feuds where even if you try to read about it or kind of unravel it, I think family feuds sometimes really only make sense to the people who are in them, like reading accounts of them.
I'm not in the family. I think both siblings in this case made some kind of public gaffe. Hmm. And it's interesting, Joan talked about it a lot in interviews. And one time, I think I was interviewing de Havilland for the 60th anniversary of Gone with the Wind, and I asked her if she'd seen her sister lately, and she looked at me with a big smile and she said, my dear, you have such a beautiful bell-like voice, but I didn't hear what you said. So she clearly didn't want to talk about it. It was private.
Yeah. I mean, ostensibly, it did have something to do with how they treated each other in front of millions of people watching as one of them.
Well, I think it dates from childhood.
Yeah.
I think they were very close in age. They were like 14 or 15 months apart. And I think that's very close to be displaced if you're the elder one, and to fight for attention if you're the younger one, you know. And their mother was, you know, for the most part, a single mother. You know, she left their father when they were very young. And when she remarried, he was a martinet, and both daughters hated him. And and, you know, they had a working mother. They didn't have a lot of attention.
Carrie Rickey, this in the next few days, I'm sure Turner Classic Movies, or I don't know how long it takes them to do this, will schedule some Peter O'Toole movies and some Joan Fontaine movies. You know, we've talked about the two that she's the most famous for, Rebecca and Suspicion. She also did Jane Eyre, The Constant Nymph.
Jane Eyre is wonderful. The Constant Nymph is Fontaine's favorite among her own movies. But I think the general agreement is that her greatest movie is Max Ophüls' Letter from an Unknown Woman. Where she is a young woman who's besotted with Louis Jourdan and carries a torch for him for years, and he kind of doesn't know who she is, but he's just he's kind of like a Peter O'Toole character who just, you know, loves the one he's with. And it's a heartbreaking movie, and it's just a haunting, you know, transcendently beautiful performance.
All right, Letter from an Unknown Woman from 1948. That's the Carrie Rickey choice for watching and for reviewing and renewing your acquaintance with Joan Fontaine. We've got about 30 seconds left. Which Peter O'Toole movie are you going to haul out this weekend and watch?
Oh, Lawrence of Arabia and My Favorite Year.
All right. Well, we covered both of those very well at the beginning of the show. Carrie Rickey, it's so great to have you on the show. I hope you won't be a stranger.
Thanks for asking.
All right, thanks.
Okay, bye.
That's Carrie Rickey. And so we're wrapping up here. We'll be back tomorrow with a show we've been looking forward to for a long time. You keep reading about these gigantic sums paid for art. Andy Warhol went for $105 million. I mean, one of his pictures, not him. $46 million for Rockwell, $40 million for a Hopper. Where do these prices come from? How does anybody figure out that they're worth that much money? So we'll be investigating the monetary value of art. Does it correspond to any kind of logic on tomorrow's show? If you enjoyed this show or didn't like it that much, you can email me at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. Thanks for our reporting from Harvard by Bobby Samuels. Thanks to all the people who talked about Peter O'Toole, the Heisman Trophy, and Joan Fontaine.
I'm Kyone of Arabia. This place doesn't seem so bad. Sandstorms. I give up. Turn back. We're turning back, everybody. I'm gonna have to floss for hours.